Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Mary Tabor, author of Who by Fire, the novel just out as we speak. My guest today to discuss film, acting, and in particular two movies that might appear to some an unlikely pair, The Third Man and Deja Vu, A Love Story, is Harvey Black. I wanted to talk to Harvey Black about these two films and about creativity in the journey of our lives, because Harvey has taken major leaps in life to do what he loves, to do what calls him. Dr. Black is a PhD psychologist who completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but he did not formally practice. I suspect, however, that he's informally been doing a good deal of therapy. As you'll soon understand when you hear his voice, he's been an announcer for National Public Radio in Wisconsin. He's also a well-known freelance science journalist with work appearing regularly in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and If You Fly, and metaphorical flying is what this show is all about, you've probably read him in the not-so-metaphorical In Flight magazine of American Airlines. But here's the part that fascinates me more and that brings Harvey Black to my radio show. In 2004, when he was, let's just say, no kid, he began acting in community theater. I'm fascinated by folks who start late, have many lives. Under his belt now are these notable plays: The Crucible, St. Joan, The Laramie Project, Arsenic and Old Lace, 12 Angry Men, and most recently, a Thurber Carnival, in which he played Walter Mitty. And not so, by the way, Harvey also plays a mean saxophone. Today, he's here with me to discuss the films The Third Man, that starred Orson Welles, with a screenplay by Graham Greene, and the actually not-so-unlikely pairing of Deja Vu, A Love Story, directed by Henry Jaglom and written by Henry Jaglom and his wife, Victoria Foyt, who stars in the film with Stephen Delane. Welcome to Rare Bird Radio, Harvey Black.
Thank you, Mary. Hello, everyone.
Harvey, let's start with, you're in Madison, Wisconsin, so it's got to be a little cold out there for Thanksgiving, huh?
Well, in Madison terms, it's not very cold. In Washington, D.C. terms, it's chilly.
Yeah, I bet. Harvey, when you began acting, did you just walk in and do an audition somewhere?
Well, in one sense, that is literally what happened, but there was a sporadic preparation over the years. I'd taken a number of acting classes and never did anything with it. But I was always obviously fascinated by acting. That's why I took the classes. And I, more or less immediately preceding the play for which I auditioned, Much Ado About Nothing, I had taken an acting class, which I thought went very well, and decided essentially, okay, enough of this, just taking classes. You know, I'll screw my courage to the sticking place and see if I fail or not. And a local amateur theater group was putting on Much Ado About Nothing. When I found that out via phone call, I had two immediate reactions. One was Shakespeare. Well, I'm not going to wait. You know, I won't even bother trying. The second reaction immediately following that was, well, what have I got to lose?
There you go.
So I auditioned using, as it happens, a bit of a monologue from The Third Man as my audition piece.
Oh, and, really?
Yes.
What did you
yes.
use?
Part of the Orson Welles' famous monologue in the Prater Ferris Wheel.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have it right here in front of me. So you did this. I'm going to read this. And this is the one, In Italy for 30 Years. This is the one, right?
Well, yeah, I'd begin.
Yeah, in Italy
bit,
for 30 years, under this is what Orson. And Orson Welles wrote this part,
well,
by the way.
There is considerable dispute about he might have written that part, but the rest of the monologue was written by Greene.
Really? Well, I'm glad you know that. That clears that up. In Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, bloodshed. They produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love, 500 years of democracy and peace. And what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. This is your famous audition piece, huh?
Right. Well, that's part of it. I began the audition piece somewhat further toward the beginning, where Welles tells the Joseph Cotton character to look from the top of the Ferris wheel, look down there. Would you really be upset if any of those dots stopped moving, or if I offered you £10,000 for every dot that stopped? Would you simply count up how many dots you could save free of income tax?
Before we get to the movie, let me ask you another question about acting, and then I'm going to actually ask you to tell, for those who actually may have not seen the movie, to give us a little summary of the film. But I want to ask you a question that, first of all, there is a book club that's on Goodreads that, if you're listening, you can join. It's the Who by Fire book club that is actually all about other writers, not me, and all the interviews that I've been doing, including I did Dana Gioia recently and Molly Peacock and others, are there. I have a cue that's been posted there, and it's from a fellow named James Greene, and he asks, Harvey, if you could offer any advice on trying to get into acting.
The basic advice is do it. I mean, if you want to do it, do it. There are, I guess, a couple of things you could do. One is if you can take acting classes wherever you are. They are sometimes offered, depending on who's around, depending on your location. The other is amateur theater, which is what I do. Amateur theater is always looking for people. And at least in Madison, men are at a premium. So that
why
may
why is that? Why would you say that is? That men
I
are
have
at a premium?
No idea. That's what seems to be the case. There are more women auditioning than men.
And what age group do you, would you say?
Well,
are auditioning.
It certainly depends on the play.
Sure.
I'm 69, so I don't audition for parts for people in their 20s. But it seems to be across the board that seems to be a predominance of women. This is, something I've heard and something I've observed. I've not really looked at it closely.
Has it been hard for you to start late, since it's been about 8 years since you actually started, right? About 2004?
Yeah.
So, I mean, was that a difficulty, that transition?
No, I just kind of did it. It was a question of, okay, I've taken these various courses, and I'm going to try it. And I auditioned, got a call back, which was very exciting. Then got cast as Much Ado About Nothing as Verges, who is, for those not familiar with the play, there are a number of comedic characters. Dogberry, who plays a constable, is one. Verges is his sidekick. I describe the two as Dumb and Dumber.
Let me ask you this, just before we move into the films, and because we really do want to talk about these two films. How has film, or has it, influenced your acting method, shall I call it? I don't want to call it the method, since that's a specific term, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I look at film, and I look at film kind of with two different eyes. That is, you look at it as entertainment, And then I look at it as, well, how are the various actors doing what they're doing? And I try to pick up hints in terms of facial expressions, in terms of line delivery, in terms of physical movement. One of the interesting things I think about acting is that there is an awful lot that goes on other than the lines. And this is probably one of those statements that someone will hear and say, duh. But physical movement, expression, turning a head one way or another are extremely important. And I do look at those and look at how people in movies and in plays do that, use their bodies, I guess is one way of putting it.
And The Third Man has been a pretty important film for you, has it not? So before we start to discuss the importance to you, could you just give us a little, this film came out in 1949,
right,
after the Second World War. So can you just give us a little summary for our listeners of what the movie is about?
Right.
Which is no easy thing. So just a short version
right.
of that, okay?
It is about, in one sense, friendship, loyalty, and morality. That having been said, I'll describe the plot. Joseph Cotton is summoned by an old school chum, Orson Welles, playing the role of Harry Lime, to Vienna, where Welles tells Joseph Cotton that Welles is running a charity. Joseph Cotton is an American hack writer. He grinds out westerns.
Pulp fiction, basically, yeah.
Right, exactly. And Cotton arrives in Vienna only to find out that Welles, Cotton has been told, is died in an accident. And that begins one part of the plot, that is Cotton trying to find out what happened to his friend. In reality, Welles is a crook, completely amoral, and has a racket, which actually did occur, that is diluting penicillin and selling it because there was a shortage of penicillin in post-war Vienna to treat illnesses. Along the way, Welles has disappeared because the police has been getting close on his heels. He has faked an automobile accident.
Yeah, this film also takes place in Vienna,
right.
And that's I think key, and it's quite the thriller actually.
Yes.
And it's so let's come. I think that sort of gives us a sense of the suspense,
okay,
as Cotton is solving a mystery of sorts.
Right.
He's trying to find out who the third man is. There's a mention of a third man at
right.
the death of Lime, and that third man seems not to be able to be found. So
right.
there's
right.
always the question of who that third man is, which we'll also talk about. I'll get your views on that. But let's talk about why this movie has entranced you, and I my sense is that it has done that for you, that you've watched
yes.
it a number of times.
Yes, it has. I've seen it six times, which may or may not be a record. But I have, people have written books about it. There's at least two books on it. So my interest is not as obsessive or deep as that of others. The film is, I find entrancing for the direction. The camera angles are just marvelous.
It was directed by Carol Reed.
Carol Reed.
That's the man.
Yes. And the Reed uses the camera angles to show how unbalanced things are, how askew
yeah,
things are.
Yeah, it's a kind of tilt, actually. I think there's a term for it. It's a tilt that he
yeah.
uses.
The film also cinematographically is also sets a mood that is just brilliant. You get a real feel for the darkness and dampness of Vienna. I remember the first time I saw it, it was on a very dry fall evening. And after the film was over, I remember hunching up my shoulders against what I imagined to be the damp outside. The lighting is just exquisite, and there are some brilliant, what I think are brilliant directorial touches. At one point, a woman who used to be Harry Lime's lover is about to be spirited out of Vienna in a way that she doesn't like, and the train leaves without her. The way Carol Reed shows the train leaving is
this is Harry Lime's lover for those listening, just to clarify. She's a very important role in the film, and
right.
She's a very very beautiful actress.
Right, Alida Valli.
Yes.
And Reed shows not the train leaving, but just the puffs of smoke of the steam engine. He also, Joseph Cotten has given her his overcoat to keep her warm on the trip, and we don't see her shrug it off in contempt because she doesn't like what Cotten has done, but all we see is the overcoat on the floor of a cafe.
Yeah, it's a great moment. And also an interesting thing about this movie is that it says starring Orson Welles, but Orson Welles is actually only on screen for 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And he has said about this that they talk about you for an hour and then you appear. That's star power.
Right, exactly.
And that's about how the movie goes. They talk about him for about an hour and then he appears.
Right, right.
So Joseph Cotten really has the major role, and he and Orson Welles were very good friends because,
right.
Of course, he appeared in Citizen Kane.
Yes, yes. He was part of the Mercury Theater group. That Welles started, and he acted with. I'm sorry. I was thinking of a completely different film where he was not with Welles.
That's okay. The Cotten role is fascinating in this film. What are your thoughts on? Well, let me give you first, since I do have in the book club Pauline Kael and Pauline Kael's book 5001 Nights at the Movies. So Pauline Kael says about the Joseph Cotten role here and what Green did here, and I'm just going to read to you what she says, and you can comment, see if you agree, because not everyone agreed with Pauline Kael. Green has made him the role that Joseph Cotten plays, the American who comes to meet his friend Harry Lime in Vienna. She says Green has made him a shallow, ineffectual, well-meaning American. Do you agree?
Well, I don't know how shallow he is, but he's certainly well-meaning. And you can look at the film as a contrast between American sensibilities and European cynicism and kind of a real world approach, where Cotten plays what could be called the naive. He is a hack writer. He has no pretensions for being anything other than that. He's not trying to pass himself off as anyone brilliant. Welles has, by offering to cut him in, eventually we see Welles offering to cut him in when they meet. We see Welles offering to cut him in on the ill-gotten gains of the penicillin racket. We see Cotten as someone who is really kind of a straight arrow, who in this case has really been, I think, rescued by Welles financially.
Well, it's a really terrific film, and I myself watched the Criterion version, and
yeah.
I was able to actually hear the commentary by Steven Soderbergh. with director Tony Gilroy. So, and the also it was the first time that I really realized that the incredible score, the third known as the Third Man score, is very famous. So I want to leave some time for us to talk about this, the movie that I've paired with this, which seems like a very odd pairing, and that movie is Deja Vu, A Love Story, by the actor Henry Jaglom. And the pairing is not so odd for this reason. Jaglom and Wells were very, very good friends. And all of Henry Jaglom's movies open, actually, with Orson Welles' face, as he's sort of Jaglom's lion, only he doesn't roar. So this movie was made in 1997, and it stars Stephen DeLane and Victoria Hoyt, who co-wrote the movie. It also has, with Jaglom, it also has in it Vanessa Redgrave, who appears in the only appearance with her mother, Rachel Kempson, who was a very fine actor herself before she had her children and decided not to actually be on screen. It's one of Jaglom's few collaborations on a screenplay. Mostly he writes all of his movies himself. And this movie is about the sense of, I'm going to summarize this one, Harvey, if that's okay.
Go ahead, please.
You can just fill in as to how you see it. There's a woman who's this is not a young woman. This is a, we would say she's in her 30s. I would say that's my guess. Mm-hmm. We're saying these are not 20-year-olds meeting. So these are people who have lives. They meet. One is engaged. She's engaged. He's married, as it turns out. And they have this moment where they see each other, and it appears as if they've known each other their whole lives. And the movie then moves forward towards that dreamlike state of, this is the person I need to be with. How did this film, you do not know as well as I do, how did this one strike you?
It struck me as really fascinating in that, yes, these people felt that they were, you know, kind of ordained to be together, and that is kind of made clear at the film's outset when the woman meets another woman while she is sitting at an outdoor cafe. And,
yes, this is an Israeli woman. She's played by Alviva Marco. She's an elusive character, very beautiful, older.
Yeah, yeah. And she essentially disappears. She says she's going to the bathroom and never returns, but leaves the woman, the younger woman, part of a pin which she was given by a lover who she had after World War II. The woman is French. And so there's, you know, there's a theme in folk music called the broken token, where lovers are reunited by means of a broken token or a token, usually a ring that they've broken, so they would be able to recognize one another if they've been separated on their return. And so that is this kind of mystery that hangs over the film.
Also, there's a sense of illusion about the film. There's one point in which the Vanessa Redgrave character, who's a friend of the family, there are a number of people who gather at a house in England, and this is one of the places where the two lovers meet again in a odd sort of synchronistic kind of way. And the Vanessa Redgrave character says, an illusion is a scent of something real coming close.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is a romantic comedy or a romantic drama, or how do you read it?
Well, I think I would say it's a romantic drama involving people who are searching for things, and sometimes they don't even know what they're searching for until you know, almost what the French say, a coup de foudre, a stroke of lightning. In this case, when these two people meet one another, their marriages are, particularly for the woman, their marriages are far from ideal. We don't get as good an idea of the marriage of the man as we do of the woman. And so I would describe it very much as a romantic drama.
The funny thing about this is that for me is that I think that Jaglom is not one who would go with sort of the idea that of the typical romantic comedy that I'm such a fan of. In fact, I think you might argue that we have all been ruined by romantic comedies, thinking that everything is the wish and the dream. Mm-hmm. But I think the film in its own way cuts both ways. I think it has a kind of irony that because we don't really see them ever after they finally choose one another. It's almost as if he cuts right there. And in that sense, there's a way that I think the movie ties very nicely to The Third Man, because there's a way that that film cuts oddly, don't you think, at the end? There's some question, actually, what happens at the end of The Third Man, to bring you back to that movie.
Right. Well, at the very end, Joseph Cotten does not get the girl. He waits for her at the cemetery where Lime, who had been shot and killed while trying to escape, actually shot and killed by Joseph Cotten.
Yes, and there's even a question of whether that's a mercy killing in a way.
Right, right.
But you're hitting on the point that I'm most interested in, and that is that the girl walks past him. Joseph Cotten is just kind of in a fog over this. He seems to be so hoping that she's going to turn and look, and she does not turn and look. It is a terrific moment in the film. It's an incredible choice, and it just does something that I think sets a tone that I think that Jaglom is playing a little bit against that,
mean. Yeah. Right. Well, I think, you know, basically, according to the commentaries on the film that you saw, there was some discussion of, well, maybe she would end up with Joseph Cotten, and that was, I think, very wisely vetoed, because it would be hard to see her and him united, because she was so, I mean, Harry Lime was her life. And so Cotten is left alone and bereft. We don't know whether he ever catches his plane out of Vienna. He is a very disappointed man at the end. His friend has turned out to be amoral, ruthless.
The other thing is that's true. The other thing is as to take us back to this ending here as we get close to the end of the show here, Tony Gilroy in the commentary with Steven Soderbergh on the Criterion version of this film, which I really recommend those of you who haven't seen this film to rent that particular way of watching this film so that you can watch it once for real with nobody's commentary and then listen to the two of them talk about this. One of the things that Tony Gilroy says, he's the director and writer of The Bourne Identity. He says every time he watches the film, he thinks that she's going to turn and look at him, but she doesn't. He keeps waiting for that moment. There's another beautiful quote in the movie, Sean in not The Third Man, but to bring us back to Jaglom, says this to the female character played by Victoria Foyt, and it is a quote from Kierkegaard, I think it's from his Works of Love. I'm pretty sure it is. The quote is: "To cheat yourself out of love is the most terrible deception. It is an eternal loss for which there is no separation, neither in time or eternity."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how you felt when you heard that line in the film.
Well, I remember that line because it did strike me. I think it is a very poignant line. The qualification that I would add, that I would make is that how do these people know they are really in love? And I think one of the interesting aspects
right.
of this film,
right?
Is,
I agree.
Is these two people are played off of this elderly couple?
Yes, I think
married.
That's so important. It's so beautifully done in the film. It's really terrific.
Yeah. This elderly couple has been married forever. We first
yes.
see them in bed. He's chewing on chocolates, which annoys her. And it's like, well, okay, that's
But she
marriage.
Sort of wants it. You see this kind of banter between them in that moment
yes.
where they over the chocolate.
Right,
and chocolate,
right.
of course, would have been after the war. This movie is kind of set sort of after the war in a way, too, in some sense, that you think this older couple has definitely lived through
right.
World War II. You're sure of that. And of course,
yes.
chocolate would have been rationed then, so yes. there's that, too.
Yes.
There are lots of ties, I think, for... I hope someday to get to talk to Henry Jaglom, but I'm not sure that'll ever happen. But I would say that there are lots of ties for Jaglom to the third man, particularly the importance of place. I think the importance of place is evident in both of these films.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, tremendously so. And in closing, I just want to, since we're at the kind of half-hour point here, I'd like to just say something, Harvey, to you and say this, that both you and I have shared limitations to the creative path that called us. And one of the things that Orson Welles, I believe, advised Henry Jaglom of is that if there are no limitations, there is no art. That is not really an exact quote, but that's pretty close. And I think that's true. You can't really find a creative solution to your life without some limitations. And both of us have experienced that by starting late. So yeah. I'd like to close, Harvey, with these words for you, and they're from A Poem I Love by W.H. Auden. And the poem is Leap Before You Look. A solitude 10,000 fathoms deep sustains the bed on which we lie, my dear. Although I love you, you will have to leap. Our dream of safety has to disappear. To all those listening and to the lovely Harvey Black who has joined me for this half hour, let me say to you that it is never too late to choose again. It is never too late to leap. And let us close with those words. Have a great Thanksgiving, Harvey, and thank you for joining me.
Well, the same to you, Mary, and it's been a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Left you on a debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting through the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. You knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. I went there and back just to see how far it was. And you tried to
up the depot with the General Workers Union. And yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. Left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money, and I wonder what you would have done.